Senator Smith has now talked for 23 hours and 16 minutes. It is the most unusual and spectacular thing in the Senate annals. One lone and simple American holding the greatest floor in the land.
You probably remember that dramatic scene in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, right? Jimmy Stewart, a principled, determined freshman senator, decides to filibuster in the Senate.
Oh, I'm sorry, gentlemen. I know I'm being disrespectful to this honorable body. I know that. And I hate to stand here and try your patience like this, but either I'm dead right or I'm crazy.
You wouldn't care to put that to a vote, would you, Senator?
And that anguish that you hear in Jimmy Stewart's voice is really the essential paradox of the filibuster. You hate it until you have to use it. But it's only been in recent years that the use of the filibuster has become commonplace, joined with its seemingly constant companion lately anyway, cloture. Between 1840 and 1900, there were only 16 filibusters in the Senate, 16 in 60 years. But in 2009 and 2010 alone, there were more than 130. Now, the nonprofit group Common Cause is filing a lawsuit in the Supreme Court claiming the filibuster is unconstitutional. The lead attorney on the case is Emmett Bondurant, a trial lawyer who practices in Atlanta and a member of the National Governing Board of Common Cause, and he joins us now. Emmett, nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
And also with us today, Gregory Koger, associate professor of political science at the University of Miami and author of Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. Gregory, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. So as I understand it, the House of Representatives actually adopted a rule in 1842 that permanently limited the duration of the debate. Why did we never get that in the Senate?
Because the Senate never saw the need to limit the duration of speeches. During the 19th century, it was a much smaller chamber, and so they could afford to let people talk as long as they wanted to talk. But it's noteworthy, though, that talking is not the only way that people filibustered in the 19th century. You can also filibuster by breaking a quorum. That is, just refusing to vote or, in the case of state legislatures, leaving the state and crossing lines. And you can also filibuster by forcing your legislature to have lots and lots of votes.
All right, but let's then help listeners to understand what cloture is, because lately that seems to be always paired with filibustering. Cloture is really just a way to end debate so they can take a vote. But in the U.S. Senate, the reason that cloture causes such a problem is because it requires a 3/5 majority to get cloture.
That's right. Once a piece of legislation or nomination is on the Senate floor, once there's been an effort to bring something up, then it's debatable. And if it's possible to debate something, then you have to find some way to shut off debate. And it does take a 3/5 majority in the Senate.
All right, so let me go back to you, Emmett Bondurant, because you've actually filing a lawsuit in the Supreme Court to make the filibuster unconstitutional. Although from what I read, people have tried to do this for 170 years. What makes you think you might be more successful?
Well, the simple answer is we're really not talking about a filibuster in the Jimmy Stewart sense. The Senate rules provide that the majority leader cannot bring a matter to the floor of the Senate either without unanimous consent. And if a single senator objects, then you have to have a motion to proceed, which is a debatable motion, debate on which can only be ended by 60 votes. The problem with that is the objectors can go home, they can go dial for dollars, they can go to Kansas City to raise money. They don't have to defend the position. The proponents of a proposal, whether it's a presidential nomination to the courts, to a federal agency, or a bill, have to get 60 senators on the floor present voting to close debate on the motion to be allowed to debate.
Right.
And then when debate begins, it can only end when you can get 60 votes. And the way the rule is being used, it is being used to prevent debate. So instead of protecting the right of a minority to be heard, instead it is being used by the minority to deny the majority the opportunity to be heard to debate. It is being used by the minority to prevent the majority from going on the record and explaining its position. So it is the antithesis of accountability. A senator can put a a hold on a bill or by objecting put this whole process in motion and never have to state publicly why he opposes the nomination or the bill. So it is the antithesis of accountability in the process. So,
yeah, you know, let me ask you, I want to play this comment that Harry Reid made very recently on the floor of the Senate. Both parties have used both filibuster and cloture in order to sort of manipulate votes and debate in the Senate. But here's Harry Reid saying he wishes he'd actually gone with the movement to get rid of the filibuster. Take a listen.
I'm going to file cloture in just a second here, which I hate to do. Another motion to proceed. Well, if there were ever a time when Tom Udall and Jeff Merkley were prophetic, it's tonight. These two young, fine senators said it was time we changed the rules in the Senate. We didn't. They were right. The rest of us were wrong. Or most of us, anyway. What a shame.
So, Emmett Bondurant, you're actually filing a lawsuit in Supreme Court. Is it a political thing? Is that what you're doing?
No, it is a fundamentally constitutional issue. This issue was debated at the Constitutional Convention. The issue of whether you would have to have more than a majority for a quorum and more than a majority to pass legislation and resolved in favor of pure majority vote. The Senate rule is unconstitutional in that it requires 60 votes in the Senate to do any business. So it violates the quorum clause. It requires 60 votes in the Senate before you get to debate or can close debate and thus come to a vote on a bill or a resolution or presidential nomination. When the presentment clause of the Constitution says that each house can pass legislation by a simple majority vote, when the framers of the Constitution intended to require more than a majority vote, they did so expressly in the Constitution. Examples, the impeachment or the conviction of a president after impeachment by the House requires a two-thirds vote. A constitutional amendment requires a two-thirds vote. The expulsion of a member of Congress by one House or the other requires a two-thirds vote.
Right. So, I mean, they've limited the need for 60 votes, but let me ask you, Gregory Coger, The Supreme Court has generally been pretty sketchy about trying to interfere with the inner workings of either the House or the Senate. And the Constitution says they both have the right to make their own rules. Do you think the Supreme Court will interfere here?
I really don't think they're going to interfere. I mean, I agree with what Mr. Bondurant is saying, is that there are some specified ways of having a supermajority vote specified in the Constitution, but those are not the only rules that require a supermajority. Both the House and Senate have a number of rules of their own creation which require a supermajority, and I don't see the court intervening in the express grant of authority to each chamber to make its own rules on behalf of an implicit or unstated assumption that there will be majority votes on other items.
Let me get a response there from Emmett Bondurant before we go.
Well, the Supreme Court of the U.S. held in 1892 that while each house has the power to make its own rules, it does not have the power to adopt a rule that would violate another provision of the Constitution. Let me give you a series of examples, the most fundamental of which is the Constitution vests in the Congress and in the President the power to make laws by a majority vote by elected people. But the Supreme Court of the United States in 1803 in Marbury versus Madison held that did not preclude the courts from ruling on the constitutionality. The Constitution gave the House, each House, the power to judge the qualifications of its own members. That did not preclude the court from ordering the seating of Adam Clayton Powell when the House refused to seat him for an unconstitutional reason. The Constitution gives the Congress the power to adopt naturalization laws. But in INS against Chadha, the Supreme Court held that that power could not be used in a way to violate other provisions of the Constitution.
And this is a taste of the arguments Emmett Bondurant might make before the Supreme Court. He is a filing lawsuit claiming the filibuster is inherently unconstitutional. Trial lawyer practicing in Atlanta. Also spoke with Gregory Koger, associate professor of political science at the University of Miami. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You can follow that conversation or a filibuster or any of our conversations here at The Takeaway by going to thetakeaway.org. We're talking about Facebook's IPO. What do you think the company is worth? What value does social networking have for you? Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.